to introduce tonight's speaker. Please help me and give him a big applause. His name is Marcy M. He's from Puerto Rico and he has 26 years of sobriety.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Marcy and I am an alcoholic. You know, early in my recovery, I went to a Native American AA meeting over in Lemoore. And one of the things that I heard was, you don't know what you don't know until you know it. And you know, I didn't know how to act when I came to AA. I did not know how to respect an AA meeting. But thank God I kept coming back and I listened to those words because I respect AA, because this is a matter of life and death for people like me. And I take it very, very seriously. I want to share just a little bit of my experiences, my strengths, and my hopes. And you know, the amazing thing is I see a lot of people that I have known since they were little kids out in here. I've watched some of you grow up. And I have a friend that goes to my Tuesday night meeting and he says, I hope you find here at Alcoholics Anonymous what I found here. And those promises that are over on the wall over there have come true for me. And they'll come true for countless others and they'll come true for you. And you know, I was, my sponsor asked me if I knew what I was going to say when I came up here, and I told him that, you know, God hadn't really talked to me yet about what I was going to say. But you know, there's a lot of people here, probably in their early recovery, and a lot of people really don't know what an alcoholic is. And I shared this when I was speaking down in Bakersfield several years ago. I was a warm-up speaker for my sponsor who has 41 years of continued sobriety. And the thing that that I wanted to share with you is, a lot of people don't know the difference between a normal drinker and an alcoholic. And I just want to share, this is not clinically true, but it's true in my case. You know, I want you to visualize a bar. Anybody in here like a bar drink besides me? Okay. I know David does. But I want you to think about this. A normal person goes into a bar. And it's a hot summer day, and he tells the bartender, I'd sure like to have a cold beer. Well, the bartender comes up, brings this big old frosty glass, puts it under the tap, pulls it, foam just flops over the top of it, ice just slithers down the side, and then all of a sudden here comes this big old horsefly. And this big old horsefly comes and goes zzzz, plop, and it plops right in the foam of the beer. Well, he calls the bartender over and says, bartender, there's a fly in my beer. The bartender says, I'm so sorry, takes it away and draws another one and says, here, have one on the house. An alcoholic of my type goes into the bar. Hot summer day. Bartender, you tell the bartender, I want a cold beer. Bartender gets me a cold beer, and he just pulls that tap, and foam flops over the top, and ice just slithers down the side. And I'll be darned, here comes another big old horsefly. And he goes, pop, lands right in the middle of that beer. And the guy kind of looks around to see if anybody's watching. And he takes his fingers and he goes down inside of that foam and he finds that fly and he puts it around his throat and he says, spit it out, damn it, spit it out. And you know, I tell that, and there's always somebody in the room who has a little laugh. And you know, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous tells me, he says, you know, that we are not a glum lot. And today I can have a little bit of humor in my life at my own expense, not as yours. So that's a pretty good deal today. But I want to share with you how and what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I like to talk about solutions rather than the problems. But I will tell you just a little bit about what was going on. And, you know, I don't want to go into a whole lot of drunk log. Like I say, I want to talk about solutions. But, you know, I came from an alcoholic family. I'm the youngest of nine kids. And my oldest brother died at 42 years old of alcoholism. And you know, the day I found alcohol, that was when alcohol did for me You have something more important to say than me?
I hear you.
Alcohol had, did for me what I could not do for myself. And I understood what that meant, a long time ago. And I was one of those types of persons that when I found alcohol, I knew that this was it. This is what was going to fix me. This is what was going to make me feel good. This is what was going to, help me cope with life. And so that's how I used alcohol. I used alcohol to cope with life. Drank alone most of the time. I needed to do for me what, what life itself couldn't do for me. And, through the years, I spent some time in the military, high school, military. And, when I got out of the military, I continued to drink, got married to my childhood sweetheart. And alcohol was a problem in my marriage from the very, very early start. And I don't know about anybody else in here, but I learned how to lie, and I learned how to cheat, and I learned how to manipulate. And that's what my life was all about. Lie, cheat, manipulate. And that's what I did. And embarrassed myself an awful lot, embarrassed my family an awful lot. And somewhere along the line, God blessed me with five wonderful sons. And my wife and I just had little stair steps. And, I always, when I share these things, the one thing that I always say is, there's a lot of things that I could talk about that I won't talk about, simply because there are things that are only appropriate to talk about with God and my sponsor. And so that, as long as I take care of them that way, that's a good deal. So this is just in a general way what it was like. And I don't know about anybody else, but I used to do these really crazy things behind alcohol. I was thinking on the way over here how the manipulation came in early in my marriage. And back in those years, I was a meat cutter. And I would stop, drink a couple of beers or whatever at work, and then I would stop at this little market, and I would get a six-pack of beer, and then I would drink three of them on the way home. And obviously, I would throw them out the door, out the window of the car. And then when I got home, I had those three beers in a little bag. And one of my little boys would come up, and I would take one of the beers, and I would just drink it, and my wife would come out and give me that hug and all that kind of stuff. And my son would go put them in the icebox, and then my wife would say, "Honey, would you like another beer?" And I'd say, "Oh, no, thanks, honey, that one was fine." Well, I'd already had three at work and three on the way there and, the one there. So that was that lying and manipulating, that I used to do like that. And the hiding and the protecting of the supply, of the alcohol. And, our big book talks a lot about hiding and protecting our supply. And, what I used to do is I used to have horses. And my wife said to me, she says, she just knew that I had this particular horse that I would pay more attention to, and if I would ride more, I wouldn't drink as much. Well, when I would come home from work, she would have my horse all saddled up, and I'd go for my ride. Well, what she didn't know is that I had a quart of Imperial whiskey down at one end of Strathmore in an orange grove, and another quart down at the other end in an olive grove in a little fork of a tree down there. And so I'd ride my horse, from one end to the other, and then I'd come home, and she'd ask me if I'd like to have a drink, and she'd fix me a little drink, a little Imperial whiskey and water, and that was pretty good. So that's that manipulation. Well, I had a bicycle, and I had a little baby seat on the back of my bicycle. And one of these particular days, I came home from work, and I put one of my little children in the back of the bicycle, and I'm riding down the street after work, and I stopped at this place called Sunrise Market. And I got myself three tall beers, and I put them inside my shirt. I always wore these shirts, David, like David wears these. What are these called, David? Denim shirts?
Yeah.
You used to wear it like this. So I put those right inside right here. And I'd ride, my bike and drink those beers. And this one particular day, I had one beer left. And I'm going around this corner, and the wheel slipped out from underneath on the sand and knocked me out. Hit my head right here. And when I woke up, there was a woman taking my baby and running into her house, And I had a beer, the one that was inside here, had opened up and it was just spinning. And, you know, beer was all over the road right there. Well, about 15 minutes later, a sheriff's car pulled up. CPS got involved, my family, my children. My wife had a restraining order against me. And that's when the trouble started. And so, you know, like a lot of people, that's kind of what it was. And I'm only going to tell you that's just the tip of the iceberg of behavior because, you know, oftentimes, thank you, dude, it's all about bigger. You know, oftentimes I hear, you know, bad stories, worse stories, and even worse stories and stuff like that, you know, and that's not, you know, that's not what it's all about for me. You know, bottom line is alcohol kicked my ass. And there came a time when I was driving my wife's car, and I was going from Lindsay out to Three Rivers, where I worked at the time. And my father-in-law had a very famous restaurant up at Three Rivers back in those days. And I worked for him up there. And so I was on my way to work, and I was pretty close to drunk. And I rolled my car on Yokel Valley Road. And then my car was sitting on an edge like this, and I remembered I had a gallon jug of Carl Rossi someplace in that car. And I can remember my ribs were all bruised and broken and everything, and I got down in that car, I got that Carl Rossi Burgundy, and I remember I just threw it just as far as I could throw it, thinking I was throwing it out in the field. And I walked out by the road, and there was that busted Carl Rossi Burgundy right in the middle of the road. I had tennis shoes on, and I'm trying to get the glass off the road, and I slashed my foot. And a rancher's wife came by, and she took me to Tonyville, and that's as far as she was going to take me. Lindsay had a hospital at the time. And there were these Catholic nuns, and they were very sweet nuns. They fixed me a drink to calm me down. Then they took me to the hospital, and when I woke up, there was a highway patrolman standing over me. And he asked me what happened. And I told him I was driving down the road, and these kids from Exeter, because I could tell by their jackets, and there must have been 15 of them in the car, and they were playing chicken with me, and they ran me off the road. And I could tell him everything but the license number of that. And you know, I believed that for years. That's really what happened. And so he's taken the report. And you know, the nuns told him that they'd give me a drink and stuff like that. And my father-in-law and my wife were there waiting for me. And it was, you poor baby, I'm so glad you didn't get killed or anything like that. Well, you know, actually, they're very lucky that I didn't kill somebody else. But that's kind of how my life went, you know, behind alcohol. And, you know, as progression happens, for me, I started doing things that I would not normally do in places that I would not normally be with people that I would not normally be involved in. And March 15th of 1988, I was probably as sick and tired as I could possibly be. And I pulled my car off into this olive grove just before I went into Tonyville. And I had Imperial Whiskey was my drink of choice, along with Carl Rossi Burgundy. And I can remember taking that whiskey out of the car, and that wine out of the car, and walking over to an olive grove and just busting it up against a tree, and I said, that's it, no more. And you know, our big book talks about swearing off with and without a solemn oath, and that's exactly what I did. I said, I'm not doing this again. Can't do it anymore. And you know, I got back in my car, and I started crying like a baby. I said to myself, how many times have I made that promise to myself, to my wife, to my kids, to my employer? But I always went back and did it. And I got out of that car, and you know, I was in church every Sunday, and I even taught catechism. So I was a pretty respected person at the time. But I was in church for the wrong reasons. I was in there for the look good. When I got down on my knees and I called upon the God of my understanding as I looked off at those mountains north of Stoneyville, and I saw those beautiful snow-capped mountains up there. It was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and there was all these beautiful gold trim around the clouds. And I got down on my knees, and you know, I didn't care whether the police chief or the Pope came by. I says, God, I can't do this by myself anymore. And I got back in my car, headed towards Strathmore, where I lived, not knowing what else I was going to do. And for some miraculous reason, the God of my understanding directed me to a man's house that I knew was very actively involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to his house and knocked on his door, and I said, sometime when you have time, I'd like to talk to you about my drinking. And you know, I thought he was going to make an appointment for me. But he says, how about right now? And that man 12-stepped me. He shared his experience, his strengths, and his hopes. And he told me, he says, you know, he says, I can't be up at this meeting in Springville Thursday night, but he says, if you'll go up there, he says, I'll make sure that someone meets you up there. And he says, whatever you do, he says, don't drink. And you know, I woke up in the morning, and I didn't do my normal routine. You know, I didn't go out in the barn where the horses were, and I didn't pick up my Carl Rossi Burgundy or my Imperial Whiskey. Didn't do either of that. I just went to work. I did not go into my boss's liquor cabinet at work. I just went to work. And you know, at noon, I didn't go pick up that woman that I was seeing, and I didn't go by and buy her wine coolers like I normally did, and park where I normally did, and did what I normally did. I didn't do that. And then after work, I didn't stick around with the guys and drink anything. Got in my car, and I didn't stop at that little store. And I went home. And my wife looked at me, and I went in to take a shower, and she says, what are you doing? And I says, I'm going to an AA meeting. And she just kind of looked at me like, yeah, right. I went up to Springville to that AA meeting, and when I walked in, I was scared to death because I wasn't like those people. I wasn't like those people. And so when I went in, all of a sudden somebody met me at the door, and they held up the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. They said, you got one of these yet? And I said, no, I don't. And they gave it to me. Well, 5 years before I went to that meeting, the judge found it necessary for me to go to AA. And my first meeting that I was going to go to 5 years prior, I was out. It was in November, and it was dark, and I was out in the parking lot. And I had a van. And right out in the parking lot, like I said, I don't know what I don't know until I know it. I didn't know how to act. I was drinking a beer in the parking lot with my right hand, and I was urinating with my left hand. And all of a sudden, there's a hand that comes on my shoulder, and I turned around to swing at this guy, and he said, you hit me, son, I'm going to hit you back. And he says, you know, recovery works if you don't drink. Well, needless to say, I didn't go to that meeting. So 5 years later, when I went to Alcoholics Anonymous for myself, because it's real easy to get somebody to sign their court card for you. And so 5 years later, when I went to Alcoholics Anonymous for myself, this one guy holds up this big book and says, you got one of these? And I said, no, and he hands it to me. And then I had some V8 juice that I was drinking. And all of a sudden, from across the room, here comes this cowboy walking across the room, and he looks at me and he says, you got a drinking problem, son? And I looked at him, and he took those V8 cans and put them in the trash, and he says, you know, recovery works if you don't drink. And it was that same cowboy that tried to help me that first meeting that I went to. And you know, he asked me, he says, what are you doing tomorrow? And I said, well, I've got a school board meeting. And he says, cancel it. He says, I'm taking you to a meeting in Visalia. He brought me over here to a meeting, and I didn't drink. And one day at a time, he started taking me to meetings. He would call me. I had men at the meetings who gave me their phone numbers, and I got their phone numbers. And it doesn't do any good to have phone numbers unless I call. And so I started calling those people. And they introduced me to the first 164 pages of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they encouraged me to read it. And I read that first 164 pages, and I started fellowshipping. I started having meetings after meetings. I started taking this thing serious. And they started introducing me to the steps. And I started working those steps. And, you know, the promises started happening. And they told me, if you feel like drinking, delay the decision to drink. Don't drink. They said, you may delay that decision for a few minutes, a few hours, and then a few days, but delay the decision. Don't do it. That's why we call. That's why we have the fellowship. That's why we take this thing serious. That's why I don't goof off at meetings. That's why I stay in meetings. I don't go outside and smoke or anything. This is just for me, because they tell me that I might miss the message. And I never know who's got the message that I need to hear. You know, even today, I hear things from people out there that are newcomers that really enhance my sobriety. Really enhance my sobriety. And I listen when people talk. You know, I don't, this is a matter of life and death for people like me. I don't care to go in and out and in and out and in and out of recovery or jail. I don't care to do that anymore. You know, and I don't have to do that anymore. And the bottom line of this for me is I don't drink for today no matter what.
Good.
That's bottom line. I don't do it no matter what. And I have learned to deal with my past. I've learned to deal with my present. And I've learned to look at, you know, my future. You know, and I do that. And is life all hip, slick, and cool all the time? Absolutely not. You know, I've got concerns, I've got worries, I've got depression. You know, I've got all kinds of stuff like that. But I learned a long time ago that this is a we program, and I don't have to do it all by myself. And, you know, they started telling me about these steps. And I can remember, I like to, and I don't read as much as I used to, but I like to read a lot of the early AA literature, AA-approved literature that was out there, and some of the transcripts and things that Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson had. I like to read those things like that because they matter. You know, they really matter. And, you know, I did those steps, and I can remember when I was told to do my fourth step by that sponsor. One of my hobbies was backpacking. And I got my backpack to his request and told me to meet him at his house because we were going to go up to Bulge Park. And he asked me to bring my pen and paper with me. And I brought my pen and paper up to Bulge Park, and he dumped my ass out and says, I'm going to pick you up on Sunday. So that's where I did my first four steps, up at Bulge Park on a Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday morning. And, you know, and God has infinite wisdom and wonderful plans for us, and I know He certainly did for me. And it's what happened was sometimes we grow differently than the people that we're with. And I grew differently with that sponsor. There were things that I needed to be fed with that I had to seek in other places. And so I was letting him know that I was going to change sponsors, and that was an okay thing, and he understood. And, you know, in that fourth step, it says, you know, it tells us how we do a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. You know, just for just a brief moment, just for a brief moment, I want you to think about, each and every one of you, I want you to think about what you perceive to be the worst thing that you've done in your life. I want you to think about that. Don't share it with anybody. Just think about that worst thing that you think that you've ever done in your life. Just think about what that is. And then I'm going to show you what worked for me. I buried that worst thing for a lot of years. I was not going to address it. I thought I could live happy, joyous, and free by not taking care of that. And the longer I stayed sober and active in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, I started regressing in what was going on inside of me. I didn't like who I had become again. I found it on the verge of being dishonest. And I didn't like that direction. Because I was taught a long time ago that alcohol is cunning, baffling, and powerful. And our big book says, without help, it is too much for us. I truly believe that. Now, I have a lot of people who tell me things like, the obsession has left me and all this wonderful stuff. And I say, good for you. You know, good for you. I know that I'm only one drink away from a drunk. I have absolutely no doubts about that in my mind. I know that for a fact. I don't play with this stuff. You know, if I feel uncomfortable in a situation, I get away from it. If I got something on my mind that I need to talk about, I share it with my sponsor or other trusted people. That's the important thing for me. I don't mess around with this stuff. And you know, a lot of people say, oh, you mean you want to talk to your sponsor about this or about that? That's kind of stupid or kind of goofy or something. You know what? If it's important to me, damn sure best I'm going to do it. And I hope you find in this fellowship what I found. And you know, a few years ago, once again, God found it necessary for me to seek a higher plane in my recovery. A different plane, if you will. Because what I was doing suddenly wasn't working as well as I knew it could, because those secrets that we just talked about started coming back into my head. And I started feeling the feelings. And I did not want to live with guilt and shame anymore. I didn't want to do it. Because I had buried that for a lot of years. And what worked for me was God put somebody in my life, and you hear me talk about two people more than anybody else. You hear me talk about my wonderful wife, and she's just, some of you who know her know that she's just an absolutely special person. And then I talk about my sponsor a lot, because those are the two most important people in my life. That's just for me. And I found that in this recovery thing, that I personally, I don't know about you, but for me, I had to take some risks. And the risks were sharing my experiences, my strengths, and my hopes with another trusted human being. And I truly believe in the power of prayer. And I prayed, and God put what I needed in my life. And with all of these newfound fears that were coming up in my head, I had a lot of fears that came up, but I was scared to death. Because remember those things that you were just thinking about, maybe that worst thing that you ever did? If you haven't, I want you to think about what it would be like or what you perceive it would be like if you talked to somebody about that. Ooh. Scary as hell, huh? Well, I don't want to live like that. I didn't want to live like that. And so, a few years ago, just before Easter, this person that I asked to be my mentor in my recovery, I said, I know you're going to San Diego for the holiday, but I want you to, when you come back, I need to talk to you about something. And he says, thank God. He says, I was going to give you about another week and I was going to beat it out of you. And then he says, I'm not going to San Diego. He says, be at my house tomorrow morning. And I'm thinking, oh shit, the jig's up. And, without going into a lot of personal details about that encounter, we he led us in a prayer before we started doing that fifth step. And we sat across the kitchen table. And I remember he reached across and took my hands because I think he was afraid I was going to run away. And I probably would have. And he said, is there anything you want to tell me in God? And I was able to share those skeletons that had been buried in my closet for all those years, even in my sobriety. And you know, the wonderful thing was that he didn't fling me to the far corners of the earth. He didn't shame me. And he didn't kick me out of his house. All he said was, now this is what we do with that. And we walked over and we knelt down at the couch and we did the sixth step. And he asked me if I was ready to have God remove those defects of character. And we did the seventh step prayer together. And then he says to me, he says, you know, we never ever have to talk about this again unless you choose to. And it's not necessary to talk about them because those things are in God's hands. They've been forgiven. And there are certain situations where I could not make amends for certain things. But I tell you what, I felt like somebody had taken a 10-ton boulder off of my shoulder, you know, when that happened. And so then he introduced me to the 10th step. And then he often reminded me that I never had to go back and pick at scabs. I don't have to go back and rehash all that stuff. I don't have to do it. And that was one of those things that I didn't know what I know until I knew it. And that's where I had someone share that experience, that strength, and they guided me and they directed me. Because I listened at meetings. I listened at meetings. And I listened to him and countless others at meetings. And then in that 10th step, he shared with me that I can do that, not necessarily just every evening or every morning, but I can do that anytime. Anytime. You know, I can review my day, and I can start my day all over again. Usually when something's wrong, it's not with you, it's with me. And I have to take a look at that and say, what can I do different? What can I do, you know, what can I do better? And I just noticed these past couple of years, particularly in my recovery, you know, life is changing. You know, it's always changing. You know, we talk about being, you know, free from the fear of economic insecurity. You know, it doesn't say that I'm going to have $1 million and things are going to be hip, slick, and cool. But it tells me not to be free from that fear, you know, of not having that stuff. And my sponsor is a big believer in inventories. And I take a lot of inventories. And I share that stuff, you know, with what's going on. But, you know, I wouldn't trade Alcoholics Anonymous for anything in this world. Absolutely would not trade it for anything in this world. And I don't know about you, but I remember I had a whole mountain of issues that I had to work through. And the thing of it is from the day that I had my last drink, March 15th of 1988, you know, to today, you know, I remember what they told me. They said, I don't drink no matter what. You know, and I talk about this stuff. And it all can be figured out and worked out. It's like, how bad do I want it? That's the deal, is how bad do I want it? You know, and I know he doesn't like me to say this, but I'm going to say it anyway. Sometimes my sponsor just pisses me off. Sometimes he's not as loving and as kind and as gentle as I want him to be, or maybe I think I need him to be at the time. And that just pisses me off. But it's called tough love. Anybody know about that? It's called tough love. And it takes me sometimes a day or two to get over it, but I get over it. And then I kind of look at myself, and you know, I have these plans, and God laughs, you know? And so does my sponsor sometimes. But it's a journey. You know, sobriety is a journey. And I have done things and am doing things that I never thought possible for me to do. And I'm not going to tell you I went to Harvard and became an attorney or any of that kind of stuff. I might tell you anything like that. But my attitude most of the time is pretty darn good. Most of the time. And I work hard at it. You know, I really do work hard at it. And I'm a pretty good guy most of the time. A lot better than I used to be. And, you know, our big book also talks about progress rather than perfection, you know. And I see that progress, you know. But the thing of it is, it's so wonderful that I don't have to worry about CPS coming and checking on me to see how my kids are. I don't have to do that. My kids were in my house. They weren't with my mama or my daddy or my aunt or my uncle or somebody else that didn't, you know, they didn't need to be with. They needed to be with me, my wife, you know. And so I had custody of my kids. And I had to jump through a lot of hoops, you know. I had to do all that stuff, but I was willing to do it. And, you know, people would say to me like this, and even to this day, I've got one brother-in-law who says, "Oh, come on, you can't tell me that you haven't had a drink in 26 years. Nobody can do that."
You know?
And the thing of it is what you think of me is none of my business. And I love that. You know, what you think of me is none of my business. And I love that. But, you know, all I can say is, and I don't have any fancy jingles or anything, and I can't quote the big book, you know, like everybody, you know, or like some people do. You know, I just, when I come in here, like places like this, and I'm blessed to be asked to speak at some, you know, places like this, and usually I'm the follow-up speaker of my sponsor who's got more infinite wisdom than I do, but, you know, what I do is, it feels so good today not to have to tell a lie to cover up the lie that I just told. That's what feels good. You know? And I don't have to do that anymore. And I don't know about anybody else, but I used to have, it's kind of like a balloon. You keep bouncing it up in the air, you know, and it just keeps going in, you know, different directions and everything, and I had to remember what I said to who and all that kind of stuff. I don't need to do that anymore. I don't jump out of back bedroom windows anymore. I don't do that. You know, I'll tell you what I don't have to do anymore, and this is, and then I'll just shut up, okay? But I used to have a janitorial business in addition to my meat cutting business, and one of the things that I did was I cleaned churches. And one of the things that I did is I did the inside and the outside. And I had a big hedge in front of me, big hedge. And there were some members of the church, they were coming and all this kind of stuff. Well, I kept my Imperial whiskey down here by the building. And I'm out there and I'm pruning the top of this hedge and everything. And this old guy says to me, he says, Marcy, does that really work? And I said, well, yeah, it really works. Well, I had my chainsaw instead of my hedge clippers. And well, maybe it doesn't work as well as I thought it, but and then what was so ironic was I would go in at night on Wednesday nights to clean the church and for their Thursday night services, and I would be drinking beer throughout the night while I was cleaning it, and then it would take me like 3 hours to clean the church, but it might take me 4 hours to find my beer can. So normal people don't do that. So at any rate, I'm just telling you, for me, Alcoholics Anonymous works when I work it. And when I am disturbed, it is usually because I'm not doing something right. And this is what I always say. I don't know if any of that made any sense to anybody but me, but I encourage you, and I always say this whenever I speak, I encourage you to keep coming back because I need you. Thank you.